de de che no ramo a apete peweko a apete peweko wara ora lo wa wara ora lo wa wara ora lo wa Peweko wane kona wara ora lewa he 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 wara ora lewa
he. A song by the Guajajara people of Brazil performed at the COP30 opening ceremony last week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Belém, Brazil, the gateway to the Amazon, where the UN Climate Summit is taking place. The answer is us. That was the slogan as hundreds of indigenous leaders from the Amazon across the region gathered in the streets of Belém Monday, outside the UN Climate Summit venue, where delegates from over 190 countries continue negotiations. These are some of the voices from the streets of Belém.
We are here fighting for our land, for our wildlife, for our birds that are facing extinction. We are here at this COP for results. We ask that Brazilian President Lula come and demarcate the land so that the illegal miners don't enter our land and our river.
We are here claiming our rights, defending our forests, defending our animals, where we have survived all these years. We need to be recognized by the world as great guardians of the forest.
As indigenous protests continue here in Belém, the government of Brazil has announced the creation of 10 new indigenous territories in response to demands from protesters. There are more than 900 indigenous delegates accredited here at COP90, the highest number at any UN climate summit. We're joined now by Diana Chavez. She is a member of the Pastaza Quechua Nation, head of international affairs and organizations for Paquiru, which is based in Ecuador's Amazon, arrived in Belém 3 weeks ago. Can you talk about where you're from in Ecuador? And despite the fact that there is a massive number of fossil fuel lobbyists, this is also the gathering of the largest number of indigenous people since the COP began 30 years ago. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us. Yes, I have been here for 3 weeks. I'm from Ecuador, from the Amazon region in Ecuador, specifically from the province of Pastaza, where there are 7 indigenous groups living there that we already declare our land or territories free from oil extraction, any extractive activities. So it has been, we know that at least 500 indigenous people from all over the world have accreditation to come here to the Blue Zone, because it's kind of hard to come in, and there is the Green Zone where more indigenous people are. For example,
you're talking about areas of the UN summit where people have to have special passes to come
in. Yeah, we have a special passes, then you can come in and at least listen to the negotiations, listen while the parties are talking about just transition. For example, as an indigenous people and part of the indigenous caucus, we are seeing the just transition program, that if it's not just transition if our territories are going to be zones of sacrifice, for example, or if countries that talk here international talking about how they are doing things to fight climate change, but in their countries have an agenda that promotes oil or mining extraction, for example.
Can you talk about what it means that indigenous organizations are pushing for their land rights to be incorporated as national climate targets?
What we're saying is that the demarcation of our lands is a way to preserve and fight against climate change. It's a mechanism. So we want that to be part of the agenda to fight climate change, because it's not recognized, it's not part of the programming to invest in the money to demarcation of land. So there are so many groups of indigenous people that doesn't have legal recognition of their land. In Ecuador, we have it, but there are so many other indigenous groups that don't have it, so that's why we're fighting for that. Because we have seen now, and there is data that shows that all of the indigenous territories here in the Amazon region are well-preserved, have the most biodiversity, and we are saving the world. The Amazon Basin, it's saving the world right now, because we have the rain, the rivers, the biodiversity, and keeping with the carbon dioxide, for example, we capture, or forests are capturing. So that's why we're having these conversations about carbon bonds, about the funds to finance climate change, for example.
Can you talk about how human rights intersects with indigenous and environmental rights? I mean, land protectors, particularly indigenous protectors, have been the hardest hit, the most killed. It is so dangerous to be an environmentalist in the indigenous community today.
Yeah, so, yes, thank you for saying that. It's hard. Like, for example, in Ecuador, our indigenous leaders have been criminalized, and there are created some laws that can target or people and be accused of terrorism, for example. Here at the COP, what we're saying is we're requesting in every part of every program that the parties are talking to recognize and respect the free, prior, and informed consent, and to end the persecution of our land defenders, for example.
Can you talk about the policies of Noboa in Ecuador, of Milei in Argentina, who Trump is bailing out now to the tune of $20 billion, and particularly their policies around indigenous people and climate?
Yeah, looks like something is happening here in South America. There is an agenda behind these governments, this right that comes from the right wing. For example, we see that when Noboa, the president of the Ecuador, in this year he passed around five laws, which one behind a door. So it was very hard to keep up, even for organizations that work in human rights, to keep up and say something or have a meeting with the committees that were in charge of this law. So this law were to protect and having released to protect the government, to help them to have this agenda for oil extraction, for mining, for example, but it's against our lands, for example. And many of these laws have articles that said, for example, that if you oppose to mining, or your organization can be closed for 4 years and you've lost the legal representation. So we need to inform this to the people, and we need to let them know that something is happening in Ecuador. This agenda of these governments that are from the right wing, it's really against indigenous rights.
Deanna Chavez, we also want to ask you about the vote that just took place on Sunday. The referendum. Voters have rejected the proposed return of foreign military bases, including those operated by the United States. About two-thirds of votes cast in Sunday's election opposed the ballot measure backed by President Daniel Noboa, an ally of President Trump. Voters also rejected Noboa's attempts to rewrite the Constitution to weaken labor and environmental standards.
Yes. People, I'm so happy, so happy. I was crying on Sunday that we won. The people in Ecuador said four times no. It was a clear rejection to this imposed decision. And I would like to mention that this was a victory, a dignity of our lives. This was for the people of Imbabura, the indigenous people from Imbabura, because they were fighting and resisting for almost 1 month against the government. We have a march over there. And this referendum, the results of this referendum shows that at least this goes for the people that were killed during the protests. And I would like to say that also this shows how people are realizing the agenda of this government, and also people want peace, real peace, not laws that says that they are going to they talk about security but doesn't show what are the plans to fight against illegal mining, for example. So the people of Ecuadorian was wise, and we both know, and we won now. The rights of nature are staying. We are going to be, Ecuador is going to be one of the examples how you can write a law for the rights of nature and how you can keep with the collective rights of the indigenous people.
Can you talk about the markings, your tattoos, and their significance, and also the meaning of your beautiful necklace and earrings?
Okay. Let me just say that I have been here for 3 weeks walking and talking with the indigenous caucus. We, all the indigenous people from all over the world, the 7 social cultural regions, we met, we talked, and we have consensus. And we see that as indigenous people, we can have a consensus, and it's hard to see how the countries, the parties, cannot get a consensus. So at least we're showing, because there is one thing that we are together, and we're joined is our land. So we're fighting to keep our territories in that way. And since I'm from the Amazon region, of course we use some ornaments that comes from the forest, and those are the feathers of some birds, the toucan birds. And these red things are seeds that help us to protect us from bad bites, for example. And of course, I'm using my face is painted with huitu, that's what we call it in Quechua, that protects us also if we are going to the war, for example. This is a way to scare our enemies.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about California and your connection to it. California, the world's fourth largest economy, a top importer of Amazon oil, particularly from Ecuador. How has this impacted the indigenous people of the Amazon? And talk about the campaign, California lawmakers seeking to curb imports from the Amazon. There was a large group of California legislators here.
Yeah, thank you. Around 2 months ago, maybe, we were able to go to California, some of our representatives, and the Waurani people also, we were there. I would really appreciate that the Congress from California, they give us a voice, and we were able to talk about what you're just saying. So I know that they released a statement asking the government of California to check of how many the business that they're having with Ecuador, and at least to stop any oil that comes from the Amazon region, which is very good. So I would like to say that about that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Diana Chavez is a member of the Pastaza Quechua Nation, head of international affairs and organizations for Paquiru, an indigenous organization based in Ecuador's Amazon. Coming up, Kumi Naidoo, the longtime South African activist, former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty, now the president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Stay with us.
Na na na.
democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit COP30 from the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined now by Kumi Naidu, the longtime South African human rights and environmental justice activist, former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, now president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, a global effort to accelerate a transition to renewable energy. It's great to have you back with us, Kumi. It seems that at these UN climate summits, that's kind of the only time we get to talk right now or see each other in person. Can you talk about the significance of this moment when it comes to the climate catastrophe in the world?
So the reality is the science told us in Paris that we need to be below 1.5 degrees. We are already pushing there. We are seeing that there is a big disconnect between the words that political and business leaders say and what actions happen on the ground. So for the last week, let's just have a quick recap what's happened. So one, we see that there's absolute corporate capture here again. There was 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists. And even though it's a struggle to get the F word said here, but the F word, we mean fossil fuels, it took 28 years before 86% of the primary cause of climate change would be even mentioned in a COP outcome document. That's like Alcoholics Anonymous holding 28 years of conferences before they can get a backbone to mention alcohol, which is the problem. And so that's one challenge. But the big debates right now are around finance. We're really stuck on finance. So there's two blocks that have emerged. So China and the G77 are talking about a seriously funded mechanism called the Belém Action Plan. And the EU has put an alternative proposal on the table, which is about basically developing countries are saying this will be another talk shop with no money. So like if you take the money is really a big, big issue here, because like you'll remember a couple of years ago, we finally got a loss and damage fund set up, right? And the governments have just committed $250 million to this fund when what is needed is $400 billion a year, right? So there's such
a big... And talk about why you think. I mean, many people in the U.S., certainly Trump himself, the president, would say, why should they be putting money into these countries?
So basically, first and foremost, it's in self-interest, right? That in the end, if developing nations, if the rich nations of the world don't support poor nations to transition and survive, the end result is that there will be growing emissions from the global south, which makes it worse, and more forest fires in California and more intense hurricanes and tornadoes in Florida and elsewhere. But the historical issue is, the facts are clear, that this old process that started 30 years ago said that we should have common and differentiated responsibilities, that all nations need to work together because this challenge is so big. But it also differentiated, it said countries like the US and Europe, who decimated the forests historically, that built the economies on dirty energy, and the historical emissions in the atmosphere are coming from those emissions. It's not to say that developing countries are not rising as well right now, but the historical accumulated responsibility still exists. And so basically, we're not asking the rich nations for a charity here. We are asking them to pay their climate debt. It's about, you know,
Well, I wanted to ask you about the historically number one greenhouse gas emitter, and that's the United States. On Monday, yesterday, I caught up with the Prince of the Netherlands, Jaime de Bourbon de Parme. He's here at COP30 as the Dutch climate envoy. I wanted to ask your thoughts on President Trump not sending a high-level delegation here and what that means.
So it's truly up to any government to decide who we want to send what conference. So I'm quite open to say, well, it's his choice not to send someone here. I think we need all parties to be constructively thinking about the future. So I would like to see a constructive U.S. present at the COPs, as we've seen in the past as well. And for now, what it is people are looking for a new equilibrium to see who's taking what role in the absence of the U.S. at this COP. So we're doing that. And we're looking for new partnerships, working with new governments in different ways because of the absence of the U.S.
What do you say to President Trump, who calls climate change a hoax, who says it's a con?
So I would say I always use the analogy of a doctor. If I'm sick and I take temperature and I've got facts and figures that I'm sick, I can ignore it or not. So it's up to him to listen to the doctor or not. But it's wise to listen to the facts. And it's truly the science tells the story. I'm not telling it. It's not my opinion. It's just listening to the experts that tell us that climate is a fact.
Finally, can you just tell us what you announced today?
So we're here with the NDC Partnership, a wonderful organization that is helping countries write the climate plans and how to implement them. And so we've added to what we're already doing for NDC Partnership another 10 million euros to work on water food nexus, to really focus on water management on these countries, because climate eventually affects water.
Thank you very much.
Thank you as well.
So that was the Prince of the Netherlands, Jaime de Bourbon de Parma, who is at COP30 as the Dutch climate envoy, speaking along with other climate ministers. I asked him about the Trump administration not sending a high-level delegation. Does that make it easier to get work done around limiting fossil fuels? Or is there a huge problem with that? What do you think? And also President Trump saying that climate change is a hoax.
I think the position that the U.S. administration is currently taking is not in the interest of the United States and its people. It's not in the interest of the world, and it's not in the interest of global cooperation. However, having said that, let's be blunt about it. U.S. participation at these COPs have often been negative. They have held back progress. They have brought down ambition levels and so on. So the good news, though, is that it's not that U.S. people are not here and are not represented. There are lots of governors that are here. There are lots of cities, mayors that are here. There's civil society here. So, you know, Gavin Newsom, for example, had a very prominent role here in the first couple of days. And we would urge the U.S. people to convince the current Republican-led administration to recognize that we need them at the table, but if they're not here, we're going to move ahead as we're doing with the fossil fuel treaty. So Colombia has called for a standalone diplomatic conference in April next year. After Easter, we will move to negotiate this treaty outside of the UN system, as the landmine treaty was done, and then we'll bring it into the UN system for ratification. So Global South countries are going to move ahead without the dominant polluters, and people should not assume that the old world order, where what the U.S. and a few rich countries do, can hold everybody back. Ideally, we want the U.S. at the table, but they cannot hold us hostage forever. We're going to try and move ahead without them.
Kumi Naidu, speaking here at COP30 last week, you said, today the leaders of the fossil fuel industry occupy the same moral equivalent position that in a different era controlled the so-called slave industry. Explain what you mean.
Well, the leaders who were trading in human lives in slavery had the same political access to power as the fossil fuel industry has. They had the same ability to control the narrative by what they could spend in the media of that time, as we have the same domination by the fossil fuel industry to confuse people about the urgency of the situation. And basically, ethically, trading in human lives then and now was never morally acceptable. Banking on a energy system that is killing people, that threatens not the planet, let's be clear, the planet will survive. This is threatening humanity's capability to survive on this planet, and people must be clear that this is being done for profit and greed, and that they are being called out now. And thankfully, at this COP, the one progress, and Amy, I think I met you at the Copenhagen COP for the first time in 2009. At that time, remember, you could hardly hear the word fossil fuels. Yeah, certainly on the streets, it's all about the root cause is fossil fuels. We need to turn the tap and stop the flow of fossil fuels. So no longer can they escape what the root cause is. And I think that we will come out here because President Lula in the first day said, we need a fossil fuel phase-out plan coming out of this. The appetite is not there. We're still pushing. But whether we get it here or not, we certainly will push in April to do so in Colombia.
Kumi, before we go, I want to ask you about two other issues. I mean, you are from South Africa. That's the country that brought the genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. You have always lived at the intersection of human rights, also climate. And you were former head of Amnesty and Greenpeace. If you can comment on what's happening now. I mean, yesterday the UN Security Council approved a U.S.-backed plan for a so-called international stabilization force in Gaza, but you still have the human rights situation where far less than half Israel's letting of humanitarian aid come into Gaza, and people are still being killed and attacked either in Gaza or the occupied West Bank.
My experience in South Africa teaches me that when those with power in context of conflicts speak about stabilization, what they are talking about often is stabilizing injustice, stabilizing the status quo. And yeah, what we are concerned, obviously we want the peace to return as best as it was, recognizing that the Palestinian people have not lived with peace for decades and decades. But having said that, of course we support a ceasefire and so on. But what we are concerned about is that the way this resolution potentially can be implemented, it will stabilize the occupation, stabilize militarization, stabilize the undermining of international law, which Israel more than any nation in the world has consistently done. So the world, the eyes of the world are watching this. We don't think that people should read this resolution as fundamentally a good thing, because the devil is going to be in the detail about how it is implemented. And right now, since the so-called ceasefire, we don't take comfort about the fact that lives are being lost both in Gaza and also on the West Bank as we talk.
And as we talk about hunger, I want to move to Sudan. In this last minute we have, if you can talk about the humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan and your continent of Africa.
So I think it's important to recognize the 12 million people, firstly, have been displaced. 12 million. Most countries in the world don't have 12 million population. Secondly, what has recently happened in Darfur? The numbers are not clear, but people are talking about bodies everywhere, absolute massacre.
Ravaging
through, yeah. People are talking about tens of thousands of people. I don't want to commit to that figure because there's a news blackout, but there is every reason to believe that that's happening. And let me just say, the global media has been pathetically complicit in their silence by just ignoring this. And that's why many people in Africa are now saying this is not just a problem with mainstream media, this is also a problem with white stream media, in the sense that black lives don't really seem to happen. If this was happening in North America or Europe, I mean, the whole world would be seeing saturation coverage. We need RSF and the previous army to comply to a negotiation process to stop this immediately. And the UN and the international community must raise the visibility and the energy in addressing this, because history will judge this as bad as we judge Rwanda at the end of the day.
I want to thank you, Kumi Naidu, for being with us. South African human rights environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative, former head of Greenpeace International, Amnesty International. Happy birthday to Ivanine Capier. Thank you to Tarina Nadura, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, and Sam Alkoff, who are here on the ground with us in Belém, Brazil, at the UN COP30. I'm Amy Goodman.
And it's Nerdword Human Surya with
Danny Nesvedarani.
And you're listening to
CJSF Radio.
Yeah, do 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 do.
Do do.
CJSF.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things: pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators, transition all existing programs to $10 a day, and plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.
Do you like music?